Old Yeller by Fred Gibson. Copyright 1956 by Fred Gibson. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Harper and Row Publishers and was produced in 2001 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. This book is read by Jim Weiss. Old Yeller by Fred Gibson. Chapter 1. We called him Old Yeller. The name had a sort of double meaning. One part meant that his short hair was a dingy yellow, a color that we called yeller in those days. The other meant that when he opened his head, the sound he let out came closer to being a yell than a bark. I remember like yesterday how he strayed in out of nowhere to our log cabin on Birdsong Creek. He made me so mad at first that I wanted to kill him. Then, later, when I had to kill him, it was like having to shoot some of my own folks. That's how much I'd come to think of the big yeller dog. He came in the late 1860s, the best I remember. Anyhow, it was the year that Papa and a bunch of other Salt Licks settlers formed a pool herd of their little separate bunches of steers and trailed them to the new cattle market at Abilene, Kansas. This was to get cash money, a thing that all Texans were short of in those years right after the Civil War. We lived then in a new country, and a good one. As Papa pointed out the day the men talked over making the drive, we had plenty of grass, wood, and water. We had wild game for the killing, fertile ground for growing bread corn, and the Indians had been put onto reservations with the return of U.S. soldiers to the Texas forts. In fact, Papa wound up, all we lack having a tight tail hold on the world is a little cash money, and we can get that at Abilene. Well, the idea sounded good, but some of the men still hesitated. Abilene was better than 600 miles north of the Texas hill country we lived in. It would take months for the men to make the drive and ride back home. And all that time, the women folks and children of Salt Licks would be left in a wild frontier settlement to make out the best they could. Still, they needed money, and they realized that whatever a man does, he's bound to take some risks. So they talked it over with each other and with their women, and decided it was the thing to do. They told their folks what to do in case the Indians came off the reservation, or the coons got to eating the corn, or the bears got to killing too many hogs. Then they gathered their cattle, burned a trail brand on their hips, and pulled out on the long trail to Kansas. I remember how it was the day Papa left. I remember his standing in front of the cabin with his horse saddled, his gun in his scabbard, and his bedroll tied on back of the cantle. I remember how tall and straight and handsome he looked, with his high-crowned hat and his black mustaches drooping in cowhorn curves past the corners of his mouth. And I remember how Mama was trying to keep from crying because he was leaving, and how little Arliss, who was only 5 and didn't know much, wasn't trying to keep from crying at all. In fact, he was howling his head off, not because Papa was leaving, but because he couldn't go too. I wasn't about to cry. I was 14 years old, pretty near a grown man. I stood back and didn't let on for a minute that I wanted to cry. Papa got through loving up Mama and little Arliss and mounted his horse. I looked up at him. He motioned for me to come along, so I walked beside his horse down the trail that led under the big live oaks and past the spring. When he'd gotten out of hearing of the house, Papa reached down and put a hand on my shoulder. "Now, Travis," he said, "you're getting to be a big boy, and while I'm gone, you'll be the man of the family. I want you to act like one. You take care of Mama and little Arliss. You look after the work, and don't wait around for your Mama to point out what needs to be done. Think you can do that?" "Yes, sir," I said. "Now, there's the cows to milk, and wood to cut, and young pigs to mark, and fresh meat to shoot. But mainly there's the corn patch. If you don't work it right, or if you let the varmints eat up the roasting ears, we'll be without bread corn for the winter." "Yes, sir," I said. "All right, boy. I'll be seeing you this fall." I stood there and let him ride on. There wasn't any more to say. Suddenly I remembered and went running down the trail after him, calling for him to wait. He pulled up his horse and twisted round in the saddle. "Yeah, boy," he said. "What is it?"
"That horse," I said.
"What horse?" he said, like he'd never heard me mention it before. "You mean you're wanting a horse?"
"Now, Papa," I complained, "you know I've been aching all over for a horse to ride. I've told you time and again."
I looked up to catch him grinning at me and felt foolish that I hadn't realized he was teasing. "What you're needing worse than a horse is a good dog."
"Yes, sir," I said, "but a horse is what I'm wanting the worst."
"All right," he said. "You act a man's part while I'm gone, and I'll see that you get a man's horse to ride when I sell the cattle. I think we can shake on that deal." He reached out his hand, and we shook. It was the first time I'd ever shaken hands like a man. It made me feel big and solemn and important in a way I'd never felt before. I knew then that I could handle whatever needed to be done while Papa was gone. I turned and started back up the trail toward the cabin. I guessed maybe Papa was right. I guessed I could use a dog. All the other settlers had dogs. They were big, fierce cur dogs that the settlers used for catching hogs and driving cattle, and fighting coons out of the cornfields. They kept them as watchdogs against the depredations of lofer wolves, bears, panthers, and raiding Indians. There was no question about it. For the sort of country we lived in, a good dog around the place was sometimes worth more than two or three men. I knew this as well as anybody, because the summer before, I'd had a good dog. His name was Bell. He was nearly as old as I was. We'd had him ever since I could remember. He'd protected me from rattlesnakes and bad hogs while I was little. He'd hunted with me when I was bigger. Once he'd dragged me out of Birdsong Creek when I was about to drown. And another time he'd given warning in time to keep some raiding Comanches from stealing and eating our mule, Jumper. Then he'd had to go act a fool and get himself killed. It was while Papa and I were cutting wild hay in a little patch of prairie back of the house. A big diamondback rattler struck at Papa, and Papa chopped his head off with one quick lick of his scythe. The head dropped to the ground 3 or 4 feet away from the writhing body. It lay there, with the ugly mouth opening and shutting, still trying to bite something.
As smart as Belle was, you'd have thought it of better sense than to go up and nuzzle that rattler's head. But it didn't. And a second later, he was falling back, howling and slinging his own head till his ears popped. But it was too late then. That snake mouth had snapped shut on his nose, driving the fangs in so deep that it was a full minute before he could sling the bloody head loose. He died that night, and I cried for a week. Papa tried to make me feel better by promising to get me another dog right away, but I wouldn't have it. It made me mad just to think about some other dogs trying to take Belle's place. And I still felt the same about it. All I wanted now was a horse. The trail I followed led along the bank of Birdsong Creek, through some bee myrtle bushes. The bushes were blooming white and smelled sweet. In the top of one, a mockingbird was singing. That made me recollect how Birdsong Creek had got its name. Mama had named it when she and Papa came to settle. Mama had told me about it. She said she named it the first day she and Papa got there, with Mama driving the ox cart loaded with our house plunder, and with Papa driving the cows and horses. They'd meant to build closer to the other settlers, over on Salt Branch, but they'd camped there at the spring. And the bee myrtle had been blooming white that day, and seemed like in every bush there was a mockingbird singing his fool head off. It was all so pretty, and smelled so good, and the singing birds made such fine music that Mama wouldn't go on. "We'll build right here," she'd told Papa, and that's what they'd done. Built themselves a home right here on Birdsong Creek, and fought off the Indians, and cleared a corn patch, and raised me and little Arliss, and lost a little sister who died of a fever. Now it was my home, too, and while Papa was gone, it was up to me to look after it. I came to our spring that gushed clear, cold water out of a split in a rock ledge. The water poured into a pothole about the size of a wagon bed. In the pothole, up to his ears in the water, stood little Arliss, right in our drinking water. I said, "Arliss, you get out of that water." Arliss turned and stuck out his tongue at me. "I'll cut me a sprout," I warned. All he did was stick out his tongue at me again and splash water in my direction. I got my knife out and cut a green mesquite sprout. I trimmed all the leaves and thorns off, then headed for him. Arliss saw then that I meant business. He came lunging up out of the pool, knocking water all over his clothes lying on the bank. He lit out for the house, running naked and screaming bloody murder. To listen to him, you'd have thought the Comanches were lifting his scalp. Mama heard him and came rushing out of the cabin. She saw little Arliss running naked. She saw me following after him with a mesquite sprout in one hand and his clothes in the other. She called out to me, "Travis," she said, "what on earth have you done to your little brother?" I said, "Nothing yet, but if he doesn't keep out of our drinking water, I'm going to wear him to a frazzle." That's what Papa always told little Arliss when he caught him in the pool. I figured if I had to take Papa's place, I might as well talk like him. Mama stared at me for a minute. I thought she was fixing to argue that I was getting too big for my britches. Lots of times she'd tell me that. But this time she didn't. She just smiled suddenly and grabbed little Arliss by one ear and held on. He went to hollering and jumping up and down and trying to pull away, but she held on till I got there with his clothes. She put them on him and told him, Look here, young squirrel. You better listen to your big brother Travis if you want to keep out of trouble. Then she made him go sit still a while in the dog run. The dog run was an open, roofed-over space between the two rooms of our log cabin. It was a good place to eat watermelons in the hot summer, or to sleep when the night breezes weren't strong enough to push through the cracks between the cabin logs. Sometimes we hung up fresh-killed meat there to cool out. Little Alice sat in the dog run and sulked while I packed water from the spring. I packed the water in a bucket that Papa had made out of the hide of a cow's leg. I poured the water into the ash hopper that stood beside the cabin. That was so the water could trickle down through the wood ashes and become lye water. Later, Mama would mix this lye water with hog fat and boil it in an iron pot when she wanted to make soap. When I went to cut wood for Mama, though, Little Alice left the dog run to come watch me work. Like always, he stood in exactly the right place for the chips from my axe to fly up and maybe knock his eyeballs out. I said, "You better skin out for that house, you little scamp." He skinned out, too, just like I told him, without even sticking out his tongue at me this time. And he sat right there till Mama called us to dinner. After dinner, I didn't wait for Mama to tell me that I needed to finish running out the corn middles. I got right up from the table and went out and hooked Jumper to the double shovel. I started in plowing where Papa had left off the day before. I figured that if I got an early start, I could finish the corn patch by sundown. Jumper was a dun mule with a narrow black stripe running along his backbone between his mane and tail. Papa had named him Jumper because nobody yet had ever built a fence he couldn't jump over. Papa claimed Jumper could clear the moon if it took a notion to see the other side of it. Jumper was a pretty good mule, though. He was gentle to ride, he could pack in fresh meat on him, and he was willing about pulling a plow. Only, sometimes when I plowed him and he decided quitting time had come, he'd stop work right then. Maybe we'd be out in the middle of the field when Jumper got the notion that it was time to quit for dinner. Right then he'd swing around and head for the cabin, dragging down corn with the plow and paying no mind whatever to my hauling back on the reins and hollering, "Whoa!" Late that evening, Jumper tried to pull that stunt on me again, but I was laying for him. With Papa gone, I knew I had to teach Jumper a good lesson. I'd been plowing all afternoon, holding a green cedar club between the plow handles. I still lacked 3 or 4 corn rows being finished when sundown came, and Jumper decided it was quitting time. He let out a long bray and started wringing his tail. He left the middle he was traveling in. He struck out through the young corn, headed for the cabin. I didn't even holler whoa at him. I just threw the looped reins off my shoulder and ran up beside him. I drew back my green cedar club and whacked him so hard across the jawbone that I nearly dropped him in his tracks. You never saw a worse surprised mule. He snorted, started to run, then just stood there and stared at me, like maybe he couldn't believe that I was man enough to club him that hard. I drew back my club again. "Jumper," I said, "if you don't get back there and finish this plowing job, you're going to get more of the same. You understand?" I guess he understood all right. Anyhow, from then on till we were through, he stayed right on the job. The only thing he did different from what he'd have done with Papa was to travel with his head turned sideways, watching me every step of the way. When finally I got to the house, I found that Mama had done the milking, and she and little Arliss were waiting supper on me, just like we generally waited for Papa when he came in late. I crawled into bed with little Arliss that night, feeling pretty satisfied with myself. Our bed was a corn-shuck mattress laid over a couple of squared-up cowhides that had been laced together. The cowhides stood about 2 feet off the dirt floor, stretched tight inside a pole frame Papa had built in one corner of the room. I lay there and listened to the corn-shucks squeak when I breathed, and to the owls hooting in the timber along Birdsong Creek. I guessed I'd made a good start. I'd done my work without having to be told. I'd taught little Arliss and Jumper that I wasn't to be trifled with. And Mama could already see that I was man enough to wait supper on. I guessed that I could handle things while Papa was gone just about as good as he could. Chapter 2. It was the next morning when the big yeller dog came. I found him at daylight when Mama told me to step out to the dog run and cut down a side of middling meat hanging to the pole rafters. The minute I opened the door and looked up, I saw that the meat was gone. It had been tied to the rafter with bear grass blades braided together for string. Now nothing was left hanging to the pole but the frazzled ends of the snapped blades. I looked down then. At the same instant, a dog rose from where he'd been curled up on the ground beside the barrel that held our cornmeal. He was a big, ugly, slick-haired, yeller dog. One short ear had been chewed clear off, and his tail had been bobbed so close to his rump that there was hardly stub enough left to wag. But the most noticeable thing to me about him was how thin and starved-looking he was, all but for his belly. His belly was swelled up as tight and round as a pumpkin. It wasn't hard to tell how come that belly was so full. All I had to do was look at the piece of curled-up rind lying in the dirt beside him, with all the meat gnawed off. That side of meat had been a big one, but now there wasn't enough meat left on the rind to interest a pack rat. Well, to lose the only meat we had left from last winter's hog butchering was bad enough, but what made me even madder was the way the dog acted. He didn't even have the manners to feel ashamed of what he'd done. He rose to his feet, stretched, yawned, then came romping toward me, wiggling that stub tail and yelling, "Yow, yow, yow," just like he belonged there, and I was his best friend. "Why, you thieving rascal," I shouted, and kicked at him as hard as I could. It ducked just in time, so that I missed him by a hair, but nobody could have told I missed after the way he fell over on the ground and lay there with his belly up and his 4 feet in the air, squalling and bellering at the top of his voice. From the racket he made, you'd have thought I had a club and was breaking every bone in his body. Mama came running to stick her head through the door and say, "What on earth, Travis? Why, this old stray dog has come and eaten our middling meat clear up," I said. I aimed another kick at him. He was quick and rolled out of reach again, just in time, then fell back to the ground and lay there yelling louder than ever. Then out came little Arliss. He was naked like he always slept in the summer. He was hollering, "A dog! A dog!" He ran past me and fell on the dog and petted him till he quit howling, then turned on me, fighting mad. "You quit kicking my dog!" he yelled fiercely. You kick my dog, and I'll wear you to a frazzle. The battling stick that Mama used to beat the dirt out of clothes when she washed stood leaning against the wall. Now little Arliss grabbed it up in both hands and came at me swinging. It was such a surprise move, little Arliss making fight at me that way, that I just stood there with my mouth open and let him clout me a good one before I thought to move. Then Mama stepped in and took the stick away from him. Arliss turned on her, ready to fight with his bare fists. Then he decided against it and ran and put his arms around the big dog's neck. He began to yell, "He's my dog! You can't kick him! He's my dog!" The big dog was back up on his feet now, wagging his stub tail again and licking the tears off Arliss's face with his pink tongue. Mama laughed. "Well, Travis," she said, "it looks like we got us a dog." "But, Mama," I said, "you don't mean we'd keep an old, ugly dog like that, one that'll come in and steal meat right out of the house." "Well, maybe we can't keep him," Mama said. "Maybe he belongs to somebody around here who'll want him back." "He doesn't belong to anybody in the settlement," I said. "I know every dog at Salt Licks." "Well, then," Mama said, "if he's a stray, there's no reason why little Arliss can't claim him. And you'll have to admit he's a smart dog. Mighty few dogs have sense enough to figure out a way to reach a side of meat hanging that high. He must have climbed up on top of that meal barrel and jumped from there." I went over and looked at the wooden lid on top of the meal barrel. Sure enough, in the thin film of dust that had settled over it were dog tracks. "Well, all right," I admitted. "He's a smart dog, but I still don't want him." "Now, Travis," Mama said, "you're not being fair. You had you a dog when you were little, but Arliss has never had one. He's too little for you to play with, and he gets lonely." I didn't say any more. When Mama got her mind set a certain way, there was no use in arguing with her. But I didn't want that meat-thieving dog on the place, and I didn't aim to have him. I might have to put up with him for a day or so, but sooner or later, I'd find a way to get rid of him. Mama must have guessed what was going on in my mind, for she kept handing me sober looks all the time she was getting breakfast. She fed us cornmeal mush cooked in a pot swung over the fireplace. She sweetened it with wild honey that Papa and I had cut out of a bee tree last fall, and added cream skimmed off last night's milk. It was good eating, but I'd had my appetite whetted for fried middling meat to go with it. Mama waited till I was done, then said, "Now, Travis, as soon as you've milked the cows, I think you ought to get your gun and try to kill us a fat young doe for meat. And while you're gone, I want you to do some thinking on what I said about little Arliss and this stray dog." Chapter 3. All right, I was willing to go make a try for a fat doe. I was generally more than willing to go hunting, and while I was gone, I might do some thinking about little Arliss and that thieving stray dog. But I didn't much think my thinking would take the turn Mama wanted. I went and milked the cows and brought the milk in for Mama to strain. I got my rifle and went out to the lot and caught Jumper. I tied a rope round his neck, half-hitched a noose round his nose, and pitched the rest of the rope across his back. This was the rope I'd rein him with. Then I got me a second rope and tied it tight around his middle, just back of his withers. This second rope I'd used to tie my deer onto Jumper's back, if I got one. Papa had shown me how to tie deer's feet together and pack it home across my shoulder, and I'd done it. But to carry a deer very far like that was a sweat-popping job that I'd rather leave to Jumper. He was bigger and stronger. I mounted Jumper bareback and rode him along Birdsong Creek and across a rocky hogback ridge. I thought how fine it'd be if I was riding my own horse instead of an old mule. I rode down a long, sweeping slope where a scattering of huge, ragged-topped live oaks stood about in grass so tall that it dragged against the underside of Jumper's belly. I rode to within a quarter of a mile of the salt licks, then left Jumper tied in a thicket and went on afoot. I couldn't take Jumper close to the licks for a couple of reasons. In the first place, he'd get to swishing his tail and stomping his feet at flies and maybe scare off my game. On top of that, he was gun-shy. Fire a gun close to Jumper, and he'd fall to staves. He'd snort and wheel to run and fall back against his tie rope trying to break loose. He'd bawl and paw the air and take on like he'd been shot. When it came to gunfire, Jumper didn't have any more sense than a red ant in a hot skillet. It was a fine morning for hunting, with the air still and the rising sun shining bright on the tall green grass and the greener leaves of the timber. There wasn't enough breeze blowing for me to tell the wind direction, so I licked one finger and held it up. Sure enough, the side next to me cooled first. That meant that what little push there was to the air was away from me, toward the salt licks, which wouldn't do at all. No deer would come to the licks if he caught wind of me first. I half-circled the licks till I had the breeze moving across them toward me and took cover under a wild grapevine that hung low out of the top of a gnarled oak. I sat down with my back against the trunk of the tree. I sat with my legs crossed and my rifle cradled on my knees. Then I made myself get as still as the tree. Papa had taught me that way back when I was little, the same as he taught me to hunt downwind from my game. He always said, "It's not your shape that catches a deer's eye, it's your moving. If a deer can't smell you and can't see you move, he won't ever know you're there." So I sat there, holding as still as a stump, searching the clearing around the licks. The licks was a scattered outcropping of dark rocks with black streaks in them. The black streaks held the salt that Papa said had got mixed up with the rocks a jillion years ago. I don't know how I knew what had happened so far back, but the salt was there, and all the hogs and cattle and wild animals in that part of the country came there to lick it. One time, Papa said, when he and Mama had first settled there, they'd run clean out of salt and had to beat up pieces of the rock and boil them in water. Then they'd use the salty water to season their meat and cornbread. Wild game generally came to lick the rocks in the early mornings or late evenings, and those were the best times to come for meat. The killer animals, like bear and panther and bobcats, knew this and came to the licks at the same time. Sometimes we'd get a shot at them. I'd killed two bobcats and a wolf there while waiting for deer, and once Papa shot a big panther right after it had leaped on a mule colt and broken its neck with one slap of its heavy forepaw. I hoped I'd get a shot at a bear or a panther this morning. The only thing that showed up, however, was a little band of javelina hogs, and I knew better than to shoot them. Make a bad shot and wound one so that it went to squealing, and ye had the whole bunch after you, ready to eat you alive. They were small animals. Their tusks weren't as long as those of the range hogs we had running wild in the woods. They couldn't cut you as deep. But once javelinas got after you, they'd keep after you for a lot longer time. Once, Jed Simpson's boy, Rosal, shot into a bunch of javelinas, and they took after him. They'd treed him up a mesquite and kept him there from early morning till long after supper time. The mesquite was a small one, and they nearly chewed the trunk of it in two trying to get to him. After that, Rosal was willing to let the javelinas alone. The javelinas moved away, and I saw some bob-white quail feed into the opening around the licks. Then here came three cows with young calves and a roan bull. They stood and licked at the rocks. I watched them a while, then got to watching a couple of squirrels playing in the top of a tree close to the one I sat under. The squirrels were running and jumping and chattering and flashing their tails in the sunlight. One would run along a tree branch, then take a flying leap to the next branch. There it would sit, fussing, and wait to see if the second one had the nerve to jump that far. When the second squirrel did, the first one would set up an excited chatter and make a run for a longer leap. Sure enough, after a while, the leader tried to jump a gap that was too wide. He missed his branch, clawed at some leaves, and came tumbling to the ground. The second squirrel went to dancing up and down on his branch then, chattering louder than ever. It was plain that he was getting a big laugh out of how that show-off squirrel had made such a fool of himself. The sight was so funny that I laughed myself. And that's where I made my mistake. Where the doe had come from, and how she ever got so close without my seeing her, I don't know. It was like she'd suddenly lit down out of the air like a buzzard, or risen right up out of the bare ground around the rocks. Anyhow, there she stood, staring straight at me, sniffing and snorting and stomping her forefeet against the ground. She couldn't have scented me, and I hadn't moved. But I had laughed out loud a little at those squirrels, and that sound had warned her. Well, I couldn't lift my gun then with her staring straight at me. She'd see the motion and take a scare. And while Papa was a good enough shot to down a running deer, I'd never tried it and didn't much think I could. I figured it smarter to wait. Maybe she'd quit staring at me after a while and give me a chance to lift my gun. But I waited and waited, and still she kept looking at me, trying to figure me out. Finally, she started coming toward me. She'd take one dancing step and then another and bob her head and flap her long ears about, then start moving toward me again. I didn't know what to do. It made me nervous the way she kept coming at me. Sooner or later, she was bound to make out what I was. Then she'd whirl and be gone before I could draw a bead on her. She kept doing me that way, till finally my heart was flopping around inside my chest like a catfish in a wet sack. I could feel my muscles tightening up all over. I knew then that I couldn't wait any longer. It was either shoot or bust wide open, so I whipped my gun up to my shoulder. Like I'd figured, she snorted and wheeled so fast that she was just a brown blur against my gun sights. I pressed the trigger, hoping my aim was good. After I fired, the black powder charge in my gun threw up such a thick fog of blue smoke that I couldn't see through it. I reloaded, then leaped to my feet and went running through the smoke. What I saw when I came into the clear again made my heart drop down into my shoes. There went the frightened, snorting cattle, stampeding through the trees with their tails in the air like it was heel fly time. And right beside them went my doe, running all humped up and with a white pointed tail clamped tight to her rump, which meant that I'd hit her, but hadn't made a killing shot. I didn't like that. I never minded killing for meat. Like Papa had told me, every creature has to kill to live. But to wound an animal was something else, especially one as pretty and harmless as a deer. It made me sick to think of the doe's escaping, maybe to hurt for days before she finally died. I swung my gun up, hoping yet to get in a killing shot, but I couldn't fire on account of the cattle. They were too close to the deer. I might kill one of them. Then, suddenly, the doe did a surprising thing. Way down in the flat there, nearly out of sight, she ran head-on into the trunk of a tree, like she was stone blind. I saw the flash of her light-colored belly as she went down. I waited. She didn't get up. I tore out, running through the chin-tall grass as fast as I could. When finally I reached the place, all out of breath, I found her lying dead, with a bullet hole through her middle, right where it had to have shattered the heart. Suddenly I wasn't sick anymore. I felt big and strong and sure of myself. I hadn't made a bad shot. I hadn't caused an animal a lot of suffering. All I'd done was get meat for the family, shooting it on the run, just like Papa did. I rode toward the cabin, sitting behind the gutted doe that I'd tied across Jumper's back. I rode feeling proud of myself as a hunter and a provider for the family. Making a killing shot like that on a moving deer made me feel bigger and more important. Too big and important, I guessed, to fuss with little Arliss about that old yeller dog. I still didn't think much of the idea of keeping him, but I guess that when you are nearly a man, you have to learn to put up with a lot of aggravation from little old bitty kids. Let Arliss keep the thieving rascal. I guessed I could provide enough meat for him, too. That's how I was feeling when I crossed Birdsong Creek and rode up to the spring under the trees below the house. Then suddenly I felt different. That's when I found little Arliss in the pool again, and in there with him was the big yeller dog, that dirty, stinking rascal romping around in our drinking water. "Arliss," I yelled at little Arliss, "you get that nasty old dog out of the water." They hadn't seen me right up, and I guess it was my sudden yell that surprised them both so bad. Arliss went tearing out of the pool on one side and the dog on the other. Arliss was screaming his head off. And here came the big dog with his wet fur rising along the ridge of his backbone, baying me like I was a panther. I didn't give him a chance to get to me. I was too quick about jumping off the mule and grabbing up some rocks. I was lucky. The first rock I threw caught the big dog right between the eyes, and I was throwing hard. He went down yelling and pitching and wallowing, and just as he came to his feet again, I caught him in the ribs with another one. That was too much for him. He turned tail then and took out for the house, squalling and bawling. But I wasn't the only good rock thrower in the family. Arliss was only 5 years old, but I'd spent a lot of time showing him how to throw a rock. Now I wished I hadn't, because about then a rock nearly tore my left ear off. I whirled around just barely in time to duck another that would have caught me square in the left eye. I yelled, "Arliss, you quit that!" But Arliss wasn't listening. He was too scared and too mad. He bent over to pick up a rock big enough to brain me with, if he'd been strong enough to throw it. Well, when you're 14 years old, you can't afford to mix in a rock fight with your 5-year-old brother. You can't do it, even when you're in the right. You just can't explain a thing like that to your folks. All they'll do is point out how much bigger you are, how unfair it is to your little brother. All I could do was turn tail like the yellow dog and head for the house, yelling for Mama. And right after me came little Alice, naked and running as fast as he could, doing his dead level best to get close enough to hit me with the big rock he was packing. I outran him, of course. And then here came Mama, running so fast that her long skirts were flying and calling out, "What on earth, boys?" I hollered, "You better catch that Alice," as I ran past her. And she did. But little Alice was so mad that I thought for a second he was going to hit her with the rock before she could get it away from him. Well, it all wound up about like I figured. Mama switched little Alice for playing in our drinking water. Then she blessed me out good and proper for being so bossy with him. Now the big yellow dog that had caused all the trouble got off scot-free. It didn't seem right and fair to me. How could I be the man of the family if nobody paid any attention to what I thought or said? I went and led Jumper up to the house. I hung the doe in the live oak tree that grew beside the house and began skinning it and cutting up the meat. I thought of the fine shot I'd made and knew it was worth bragging about to Mama. But what was the use? She wouldn't pay me any mind. Not until I did something she thought I shouldn't have done. Then she'd treat me like I wasn't any older than little Arliss. I sulked and felt sorry for myself all the time I worked with the meat. The more I thought about it, the madder I got at the big yeller dog. I hung the fresh cuts of venison up in the dog run, right where old Yeller had stolen the hog meat the night he came. I did it for a couple of reasons. To begin with, that was the handiest and coolest place we had for hanging fresh meat. On top of that, I was looking for a good excuse to get rid of that dog. I figured if he stole more of our meat, Mama would have to see that he was too sorry and no account to keep. But old Yeller was too smart for that. He gnawed around on some of the deer's leg bones that Mama threw away, but not once did he ever even act like he could smell the meat we'd hung up. Chapter 4. A couple of days later, I had another and better reason for wanting to get rid of old Yeller. That was when the 2 Longhorn Range Bulls met at the house and pulled off their big fight. We first heard the bulls while we were eating our dinner of cornbread, roasted venison, and green watercress gathered from below the spring. One bull came from off a high rocky ridge to the south of the cabin. We could hear his angry rumbling as he moved down through the thickets of cat claw and scrub oak. Then he lifted his voice in a wild, brassy blare that set echoes clamoring in the draws and canyons for miles around. "That old bull's talking fight," I told Mama and little Arliss. "He's bragging that he's the biggest and toughest and meanest. He's telling all the other bulls that if they got a lick of sense, they'll take to cover when he's around." Almost before I'd finished talking, we heard the second bull. He was over about the Salt Licks somewhere. His bellerin' was just as loud and braggy as the first one's. He was telling the first bull that his fight talk was all bluff. He was saying that he was the he-bull of the range, that he was the biggest and meanest and toughest. We sat and ate and listened to them, We could tell by their rumblings and bawlings that they were gradually working their way down through the brush toward each other and getting madder by the minute. I always like to see a fight between bulls or bears or wild boars or almost any wild animals. Now I got so excited that I jumped up from the table and went to the door and stood listening. I'd made up my mind that if the bulls met and started a fight, I was going to see it. There was still plenty of careless weeds and crabgrass that needed hoeing out of the corn, but I guessed I could let them go long enough to see a bullfight. Our cabin stood on a high knoll, about 100 yards above the spring. Years ago, Papa had cleared out all the brush and trees from around it, leaving a couple of live oaks near the house for shade. That was so we could get a clear shot at any Comanche or Apache coming to scalp us. And while I stood there at the door, the first bull entered the clearing, right where Papa had one time shot a Comanche off his horse. He was a leggy, mustard-colored bull with black freckles speckling his jaws and the underside of his belly. He had one great horn set for hooking, while the other hung down past his jaw like a tallow candle that had drooped in the heat. He was what the Mexicans called a chongo, or droop horn. He trotted out a little piece into the clearing, then stopped to drop his head low. He went to snorting and shaking his horns and pawing up the dry dirt with his forefeet. He flung the dirt back over his neck and shoulders in great clouds of dust. I couldn't see the other bull yet, but I could tell by the sound of him that he was close and coming in a trot. I hollered back to Mama and little Arliss. They're fixing to fight right there, where we can all see it. There was a split rail fence around our cabin. I ran out and climbed up and took a seat on the top rail. Mama and little Arliss came and climbed up to sit beside me. Then, from the other side of the clearing came the second bull. He was the red roan I'd seen at the Salt Licks the day I shot the doe. He wasn't as tall and long-legged as the chongo bull, but every bit as heavy and powerful. And while his horns were shorter, they were both curved right for hooking. Like the first bull, he came blaring out into the clearing, then stopped to snort and sling his wicked horns and paw up clouds of dust. He made it plain that he wanted to fight just as bad as the first bull. About that time, from somewhere behind the cabin came Old Yeller. He charged through the rails, bristled up and roaring almost as loud as the bulls. All their bellering and snorting and dust pawing sounded like a threat to him. He'd come out to run them away from the house. I hollered at him. "Get back here, you rascal," I shouted. "You're fixing to spoil our show." That stopped him, but he still wasn't satisfied. He kept baying the bulls till I jumped down and picked up a rock. I didn't have to throw it. All I had to do was draw back like I was going to. That sent him flying back into the yard and around the corner of the cabin, yelling like I'd murdered him. That also put little Arliss on the fight. He started screaming at me. He tried to get down where he could pick up a rock, but Mama held him. "Hush now, baby," she said. "Travis isn't going to hurt your dog. He just doesn't want him to scare off the bulls." Well, it took some talking, but she finally got little Arliss's mind off hitting me with a rock. I climbed back up on the fence. I told Mama that I was betting on Chongo. She said she was betting her money on Roney because he had 2 fighting horns. We sat there and watched the bulls get ready to fight and talked and laughed and had ourselves a real good time. We never once thought about being in any danger. When we learned different, it was nearly too late. Suddenly, Chongo quit pawing the dirt and flung his tail into the air. Look out, I shouted. Here it comes. Sure enough, Chongo charged, pounding the hard pan with his feet and roaring his mightiest. And here came Roni to meet him, charging with his head low and his tail high in the air. I let out an excited yell. They met head on with a loud crash of horns and a jar so solid that it seemed like I could feel it clear up there on the fence. Roni went down. I yelled louder, thinking Chongo was winning. A second later, though, Roni was back on his feet and charging through the cloud of dust their hoofs had churned up. He caught Chongo broadside. He slammed his sharp horns up to the hilt in the shoulder of the mustard-colored bull. He drove against him so fast and hard that Chongo couldn't wheel away. All he could do was barely keep on his feet by giving ground. And here they came, straight for our rail fence. "Land sakes!" Mama cried suddenly, and leaped from the fence, dragging little Alice down after her. But I was too excited about the fight. I didn't see the danger in time. I was still astride the top rail when the struggling bulls crashed through the fence, splintering the posts and rails and toppling me to the ground almost under them. I lunged to my feet, wild with scare, and got knocked flat on my face in the dirt. I sure thought I was a goner. The roaring of the bulls was right in my ears. The hot, reeking scent of their blood was in my nose. The bone-crashing weight of their hoofs was stomping all around and over me, churning up such a fog of dust that I couldn't see a thing. Then suddenly Mama had me by the hand and was dragging me out from under, yelling in a scared voice, "Run, Travis, run!" Well, she didn't have to keep hollering at me. I was running as fast as I ever hoped to run. And with her running faster and dragging me along by the hand, we scooted through the open cabin door just about a quick breath before Roni slammed Chongo against it. They hit so hard that the whole cabin shook. I saw great big chunks of dried mud chinking fall from between the logs. There for a second, I thought Chongo was coming through that door right on top of us. But turned broadside like he was too big to be shoved through such a small opening. Then a second later, he got off Roni's horn somehow and wheeled on him. Here they went then, down alongside the cabin wall, roaring and stomping and slamming their heels against the logs. I looked at Mama and little Arliss. Mama's face was white as a bedsheet. For once, little Arliss was so scared that he couldn't scream. Suddenly, I wasn't scared anymore. I was just plain mad. I reached for a braided rawhide whip that hung in a coil on a wooden peg driven between the logs. That scared Mama still worse. "Oh, no, Travis," she cried. "Don't go out there." "They're fixing to tear down the house, Mama," I said. "But they might run over you," Mama argued. The bulls crashed into the cabin again. They grunted and strained and roared. Their horns and hoofs clattered against the logs. I turned and headed for the door. Looked to me like they'd kill us all if they ever broke through those log walls. Mama came running to grab me by the arm. "Call the dog," she said. "Put the dog after them." Well, that was a real good idea. I was half aggravated with myself because I hadn't thought of it. Here was a chance for the old yeller dog to pay back for all the trouble he'd made around the place. I stuck my head out the door. The bulls had fought away from the house. Now they were busy tearing down more of the yard fence. I ducked out and around the corner. I ran through the dog run toward the back of the house, calling, "Here, yeller! Here, yeller! Get him, boss! Sick him!" Old yeller was back there, all right, but he didn't come. And it didn't sick him. He took one look at me running toward him with that bullwhip in my hand and knew I'd come to kill him. He tucked his tail and lit out in a yelling run for the woods. If there had been any way I could have done it, right then is when I would have killed him. But there wasn't time to mess with a fool dog. I had to do something about those bulls. They were wrecking the place, and I had to stop it. Papa had left me to look after things while he was gone, and I wasn't about to let two mad bulls tear up everything we had. I ran up to the bulls and went to work on them with the whip. It was a heavy